KMC HD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Enlightened philosophers tell us that we are divine beings in human form. Let's get real here. How can we live a busy life with a job, kids, and a mortgage and still be spiritual? Join CJ Liu as she tackles real life issues through a spiritual lens and talks with experts in relationships, work, and more. You'll get practical life skills and learn how to touch, feel, and experience a whole new way of living. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
And welcome in, everyone. We are live here at CBS New Sky Radio, New Horizons, No Boundaries. Fire It Up with CJ. Now can be found at fireitupwithcj.com, and welcome to May, where this month we'll be focusing on women and empowering them, us or them, depending on the listener, to be the very best. We have a great guest today. We'll get the show started. CJ, we'll send it to you.
Hey, welcome everybody. I'm CJ Liu, and this weekend my eyes were glued on Linda Greenlaw's book, Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. And I've got to tell you, everything about Linda breaks a mold. First of all, she is a fisherman, which is not a traditional role for females. In fact, she is one of the best sea captains in the world, I'll say. I'm not sure if that's true, but I know on the East Coast. And instead of pursuing a traditional marriage with kids, she has been married to the sea. And for about 30 years, and she opted to adopt a teenage girl who was like 15, I think. And the book talks about how she co-parents her daughter with not only her real-life family, with her sisters and mom and dad, but her boyfriend and her small island community with 40 people. So it's a fabulous story, and it's really how she accidentally becomes a mother. So welcome, Linda. Are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's great having you here. So I found this book completely fascinating. I just could not stop reading it, and I kept on talking to my kids about it, and they kept on saying, Mommy, is it a true story or is it a made-up story? I'm like, it's true. It's true.
All right. Well, I love hearing that people are enjoying it, so thank you for that.
Yeah, so tell me, how did you accidentally, does anyone ever really accidentally become a mother? How did you accidentally become a mother?
Well, you know, this young girl on the island was in a bad situation, and she needed a place to stay at first temporarily because we didn't understand exactly what the situation was she was in. We assumed that her guardian at the time wasn't taking very good care of her because he had an alcohol problem. Mm-hmm. We didn't understand what was actually going on in the home until much later, which is, you know, she was being abused in many ways. So she was going to stay with me until her guardian sort of got back on, the straight and narrow. And then as things unfolded, it became clear that she couldn't go back. Not only could she not go back to that situation, but in fact, the law had to come in, and her former guardian's now in federal prison. So here we are on this little island, and this kid is either going off the island to go into a foster care program, which, you know, at the age of 15, I can't imagine a worse situation. So I was pretty much nominated. It was that simple. My community said, hey, Linda, you have a spare bedroom. You know, why don't, you know, you can have her. You've always wanted kids. And it was really that simple, and frighteningly simple to become a legal guardian. It would have been more difficult to get a puppy at a pound.
I know. I was kind of shocked that there was a pivotal moment in the story in your book when you just say, "Well, I'm going to adopt her," you know, which was shocking. Was it shocking for you when those words kind of when I read the book, it felt like it was just kind of spilled out of your mouth. You're like, "What? What just happened?"
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it happened. I don't want to ruin anything for people who haven't read the book, but It was a very tense moment, and I was pretty much confronting her former guardian, who had not been arrested yet. And he was saying that he wanted his girl back, and I just, you know, really, it did just spill out of my mouth. It's like, you know, in fact, I'm going to become her guardian, and if you fight me, you will lose. And he understood that. He understood that he wasn't providing a good home. He didn't know that we knew what we did. He was assuming that we just all thought he had a drinking problem at that time.
Mm. Now, when you look back, do you think, I mean, nothing, I always believe, in my spiritual beliefs, there's nothing that's accidental. I mean, when you look back, do you think this was an accident or it wasn't? I mean, how do you look back at it now in retrospect?
When I look now, and my daughter is just turned 21, and I look back now and I think it wasn't accidental at all. When 15, 16, 17 years old, it was a very difficult relationship that we had. And not only did I think it was an accident, I thought it was a bad one.
Mm-hmm. All of us mothers do.
Sure. You know, that's what my girlfriends kept telling me, you know, the girlfriends who had raised daughters, like, oh, you know, gee, that's nothing. It's absolutely normal. I'm like, nah, you've got to be kidding me, right?
I love there's a part in the book when you say, I'm a sea captain. What do I know about raising a teenage girl? And I thought, no, that is the perfect, someone who actually can deal with the perfect storm, the emotions that arise from these teenagers, irrationality, to be emotionally stable during the whole time and patient and just, you know, hold for it while chaos is reigns.
Right. I guess, you know, that's one perspective. But my perspective is that absolutely nothing in my fishing career nor my writing career prepared me for becoming a mother figure for anyone. And, you know, I think about my role as a captain of a boat and being just absolutely inflexible. And, you know, you think of sort of the cliche advice to parents. You know, the one that comes to mind is like choosing your battles, and that, you know, indicates that you'd actually be willing to bend a little bit on some things, and that just wasn't in my game book. So that really not good parenting to just never ever, you know, be willing to give in at all. And on the other hand, you know, being an author is almost the opposite. You know, it's like you get in your bubble and nothing penetrates from the outside. You just ignore everything on the outside, and that's really not very good parenting skills either. I think the one thing that I had in my favor was, and still is, my relationship with my parents. I mean, I understood how it was supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that being a mom helped you become a better fisherman or fisherwoman and writer?
Certainly a better writer, because it's just, you know, just a different type of stimulation, and really broadened, I guess, you know, just really broadened my my basis for everything,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. You know, having a daughter, having a, you know, child, even starting at the age where she was 15, you know, enriched my life in a lot of ways, and certainly, you know, enriching and stimulating. It's always good for writing.
So how old were you when you adopted your daughter at age 15?
Well, let's see. It was 6 years ago, and I am 52, so I guess it made me 46.
Well, that's perfect. I mean, that's probably I'm around that age, and that's when, you know, you have kids this age. So in some ways, you missed all the baby dirty diapers, tantrums. It's fascinating. I think it's kind of fascinating how life works out that way. Because you just get, I mean, you kind of like didn't really miss a beat. You're completely on schedule, but you just miss those beginning 15 years. I think that's
right,
fascinating.
Yeah, I've been jokingly saying that, you know, the stork left a 15-year-old kid on my porch.
All right. So when in the book you say that your daughter needed you and you needed her, and what did you mean by that? I mean, I think I know from reading a book, but I want to hear from you directly, because I'm just presuming what I would imagine you'd say.
You know, to my mind, you know, looking, you know, of course, in the writing process, you end up being a lot more introspective and examining things in a far different way than you do when you're actually living them and not really looking closely at a lot of things. And I really lived a very selfish life for 46 years. I never really had anyone that I had to be responsible for. I didn't have to worry if anybody was cold or hungry or tired or sad. And I never, you know, I think that's a pretty selfish way to live your life. And I was happily living it that way. So, you know, I definitely needed, something to concentrate on other than myself. So that, you know, that having a daughter definitely filled that need. My daughter needed, she needed a mother figure. She needed a parental figure. Up until the age of 15, the adults or the people who were supposed to be parenting her, you know, she'd just been bounced around a lot and abused. She had, like, no trust of adults pretty much in general for good reason. You know, she'd just been disappointed and, you know, worse than disappointed so many times that she needed consistency. She needed to know that, you know, when the chips were down, I wasn't going to, you know, cast her aside or give her away or sell her or, you know, whatever. And
sell her?
Well, you know, we're not sure whether her biological mother gave her away or sold her.
Oh, my God.
We don't know. So that's why, I guess that's why I said that. I know. It's pretty shocking.
That's shocking and dismaying. Okay, wow. Okay, I had no idea. Wow.
Yep.
Well, oh, wow.
She was either given away or sold to a pedophile.
Oh, God, that is just terrifying. All right,
so. She was quite young. It is. It's disgusting.
Yeah. So. Wow. Okay. So, I find I have like 1,000 questions afterwards, but the thing that's so interesting, so she needed, in some ways, she needed exactly what you had as being a captain, right? In some ways, the inflexibility that you describe as, you know, a problem ends up being probably the kind of consistency and structure that she probably never had and really needed. And I find it interesting that you call your life selfish. It sounds fabulous to me. I want to be a sea captain. I think it sounds fabulous. And it seems like you're, and this is what I don't, because I kept on reading a book and I don't get it. Because she's responsible for everyone on the boat. She's responsible for their life, you know, their safety, their well-being, their protection, making sure that they're safe. I mean, so I don't get it.
Well, I don't know, but it's not, you know, it's not a loving personal relationship.
Ah, okay. You're not giving all those guys on the fish on the boat hugs and
no,
snuggling
them. No.
Okay. All right. So you said that throughout the book, you talk about you wanted to change, and change was something that you thrive on and you look forward to. How do you think being a mom changed your life for the better?
Well, along with change, I guess, you know, I thrive on challenge. And I think it's certainly very challenging to do a good job parenting. Mm-hmm. And particularly starting with a 15-year-old, as you say, you know, I didn't go through the diaper changing and the learning to ride a bike and all the different stages that kids go through. And 15-year-old girls are not always easy to deal with the teenage years. And my daughter is a perfect example of a very difficult teen.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge challenge. You know, we both got through it. And our relationship's really good now. But boy, it was certainly tough.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we are going to be, coming right back talking more about, what you're trying to do with the book and in your intention with the book. We have Linda Greenlaw, author of Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. We'll be right back. And make sure, folks, to subscribe to get great shows like this one at www.firedupwithcj.com. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, firedupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. Sky.
And welcome back, everyone. Live here at The Sky, New Horizons, No Boundaries. It is Fired Up with CJ, now available on iTunes. Our guest today, Linda Greenwald, author of Life-Saving Lessons, Note from an Accidental Mother. This is Brandon. I'm filling in for Cassandra today. We'll send it to you, CJ.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm CJ Liu, and we have Linda Greenlaw, who is sharing her story of how an entire island of 40 people, who's actually a relatively close island, was actually duped by an extremely clever pedophile, and how the whole event of uncovering that there was a pedophile among their midst who had been abusing this little girl for many, many years, really shook the idyllic community that she lived in, and how it also shook her own sense of safety. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Welcome back, Linda.
Thank you.
So, I mean, when you look back at the whole situation, I mean, how would you describe how it affected, how finding a pedophile among your midst affected the island, affected you, affected the way you looked at things?
I, from my perspective, I think the biggest change that came about, you know, by like discovering this pedophile on the island was it really, bothered me the way I interacted with kids. I became extremely paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say it takes a village to raise a child, and in this very small, close-knit community, everyone is very involved with every kid on the island. And I would think nothing of, you know, hugging any kid. Every time I see them, I, like, throw my arms around them, pat them on the head, pat them on the butt, you know, all these things. And it started making me think, wow, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. Checking into hotel with my daughter when she was 15, 16, I'm thinking, God, I wonder, do we need separate rooms?
It
really affected the way I interact with kids, and I, you know, I like to think that I'm kind of getting through that and thinking, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's not inappropriate, but it makes you look at things differently.
Yeah, and it's sad because, I mean, all those gestures are a sign of intimacy and connection, and then when you feel like, well, now I can't do those, or I'm second-guessing whether these things are appropriate, and I'm sure that was probably true of everyone on the island, right?
Yes, I think it was. And, you know, one of the things, something that comes to mind right as we're talking is one of the things when my daughter was 15, 16, one of the things that really bothered me was she had a way of getting men's attention. It was always physically.
Mm-hmm.
She would either go over and start playing with their hair or try to sit in their lap. Obviously, inappropriate. 15-year-old girl should not be climbing into a grown man's lap. It's
right.
Like one of my friends or, you know, whatever.
Right.
Giving a man a hug, not just a little hug, but I'm talking like a full-on embrace.
Right.
And trying to, it's tough, you know. I was thinking, well, you know, she'll observe me and she'll see the appropriate way, you know, to get someone's attention. Maybe is to engage them in conversation. Not everything has to be physical. In that, again, I started thinking, gee, everything doesn't have to be physical, and maybe I shouldn't be, like, touching and hugging all these kids, and it's just really a terrible thing to think.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because so much of affection for another person is through physical gestures, and so when you're always kind of second-guessing those things or not sure, that's really hard. And then also if you have a child who really doesn't know what's appropriate, it's like, well, you know, how do you – I don't know. And nowadays, it seems like everything's inappropriate anyways.
Right. Yeah. You don't dare do anything. I mean, isn't that sad?
I know. It's really sad. So did you feel a sense of, I mean, and then what was so incredible is that there were other pedophiles or other people in the island, right, that had kind of similar types of things that were hidden and
yeah, so
and
we
dark.
Were aware that we had one convicted pedophile on the island. He's been there for many years, and he's sort of ostracized, but, you know, he lives on the island. He fishes around the island. No one really socializes with him. He keeps to himself. People are obviously nervous. They don't want his kids around him, and that's, you know, a tough way to bring up a kid. You know, you're in this paradise, but, you know, they have to be told to not, you know, be alone with certain people, and it's tough, but... Anyway.
Yeah. I know. Here's the thing that's so frustrating, because in some ways I would want to still not be ignorant that, you know, there's always going to be people who are doing things that you're not happy with or doing things that are criminal. I mean, it's, whether you like it or not, and to have that affect your vision of your paradise, that, I don't know, that would just make me mad.
That was a major effect, you know, of discovering what was going on. And that was, wow, you know, this is one of the islanders are all the most coveted description of ourselves is that we're islanders and we love the island. And then, you know, it's almost like the island's poisoned by that.
Yeah. And I think it's important not to get it poisoned. You know what I mean? It's important not to, because if I think when you let those kind of dark energies and ideas kind of infiltrate, they kind of darken what's beautiful. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it'd be realistic, but not have it darken everything.
Right. And, you know, and it was dark, but it was temporary.
Yeah.
You know, and we all realize that it's still the place that we know and love. And, you know, there are some people there that have done some things, and there are bad people, and there are bad people everywhere, even on our beautiful island.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about you had said that, you know, you reveal so many intimate details about your life, your daughter's life, and it's probably easier not to have written the book, right? I mean, it's so personal. But what gave you the conviction and your daughter the desire to reveal these really private details to other people? What impact did you hope the book would have?
Hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I know we're doing a show, and I've got to move to another room because someone's talking on another phone.
Okay. Oh, no problem. So my question was that. My question, the short version of, is that you reveal so many personal details about your life and your daughter's life, and I guess I'm asking you why. What was the intention or greatest hope that you would have by publishing this book?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, because the question is usually asked, like, what does your daughter think of this? And she's been on board since way before the writing process about my writing this story. And she understands that it's our story, but it's my perspective of our story. Mm-hmm. She's been very much in favor of this book, and her wishes, I guess her hopes for the book, are that somebody somewhere someday will read this book and sort of have the courage to, you know, to break out of a situation the way she did.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter literally physically ran from her abuser with him chasing her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a nightmare, but that's what she needed to do, and that was, you know, what got the ball rolling. She ran from him.
Mm-hmm.
So she hopes that someone will read the book and say, hey, you know what, that's what I need to do, and maybe have the courage, and believe me, I'm imagining that it took quite a lot of courage for her to do that.
Yeah, to actually stand up to your abuser and point out, like, someone's abusing me. I think that's probably, from what I understand about people who have been abused, that's probably the hardest step to take.
I'd say it is. And, you know, there's always this, and I know that on the island we all had this, why didn't she tell us sooner? You know, mm-hmm. And it just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm. How does it work? I mean, I'm sure you've talked to your daughter, like, why didn't you tell us sooner? I mean, what does she say? Why isn't she? And what could you have done? Is there anything you could have done to help her? I don't know. I don't know,
you know, looking back, if there's anything that anyone could have done. She actually sort of spilled the beans, the whole truth and nothing but the truth at the very first session with a counselor. And I took her to the counselor because the woman on the island said, gee, you know, this kid's been bounced around quite a bit. Maybe she should talk to someone. And so I took her, and again, we just thought she was living with an alcoholic. We didn't know the rest of the story at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her opportunity to really open up, and she did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly not a trained professional. I wouldn't have known what to ask. I mean, this woman, the counselor, basically asked my daughter if she had privacy in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gee, I'd never think to ask that of anyone. I didn't, because I didn't suspect anything.
Right.
So anyway, I don't think there's anything anyone could have done to to have that happen sooner. And I've learned from people who are much more experienced in dealing with, you know, victims of sexual abuse or any type of abuse, that you just never really know, especially with a kid, when the truth will come out, if ever. It just sometimes it just comes out just with no prompting at all. You just don't know.
What did she ever tell you why at that moment? Was it because at that point she really felt her physical life was in jeopardy, like she was in jeopardy, or life was in jeopardy, or what?
Well, I know that she physically ran from him because she was just pretty much at the end of her rope. But even, you know, after she told the truth to the counselor, and I was at that session with her, when the counselor said, well, I hope you understand, we, you know, have to call the authorities and I have to let the state know, we were on our way home back to the island after that one-hour session, and my daughter was saying, is he really in trouble? And I'm like, oh, yeah. But she didn't know. I mean, she'd been this way. She said, well, some of the things were wrong, but, gee, I didn't know he'd be, like, in trouble. She just didn't know. She didn't know. How would she?
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation, because in some ways your normalcy and what you would expect is based on what you've experienced so far. So how would she have known that there was something, there was someone that she needed to alert because she thought that that was normal? Anyways, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but at 15, you know, she was getting, you know, older and wiser, and she knew some of it was wrong, but she just didn't realize that it was, oh, hey, guess what? It's really wrong and it's really illegal. And, yeah, he's in big trouble.
Wow. Thank you so much for being here, writing this book. And it's a fascinating read and a beautiful story. Really,
well,
it's the hero's journey that both you and your daughter took. And I loved reading it. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, make sure to stay tuned, because we're going to be talking about ending violence and how you can respond to violence yourself. So we'll be right back.